and velkommen to the history of Denmark. Episode 20, Christian the Fourth, Part 2. Hello everyone, you heard correctly, this is the History of Denmark podcast. The intro music has been changed for this episode, as the anthem you just heard has a special connection to events we will cover today. Stay tuned to find out what that connection is. Last time we covered the first part of the incredibly long reign of Christian the Fourth, the most famous king of Denmark. The topics and areas we covered were ones in which the king was largely successful, whereas what we shall cover today will contain the low points of his reign. We looked at the Kalmar War, started over trade disputes in the Baltic Sea, as well as taxation rights to northern Norway. It ended slightly in favor of the Danes, with Sweden being forced to pay a large sum of money to Christian. We then followed him as he spent this money on building projects, particularly in Copenhagen, but also all over the realm, where he constructed new cities and renovated castles. The capital saw iconic buildings like Rosenborg Castle, the Stock Exchange, and the Round Tower shoot up, which are to this day some of the most popular attractions in the city. We also briefly covered Christian's love life and his views on religion. Finally, we went overseas and saw the establishment of the first Danish colony in India, Trankebar, and we finished off by quickly covering some other Danish explorers from this time period. Today, the main topic will be the 30 Years' War, which lasted from 1618 to 1648, thus corresponding almost exactly to the second half of the reign of Christian IV. This complicated conflict would have major consequences not just for the history of Denmark, but also for Europe as a whole. The Holy Roman Empire would be severely weakened and, more importantly for our story, it set the stage for what is known in Swedish as Stormaktstiden, the era of great power, where the country ascended to a major player on the European stage. Although his involvement in the 30 Years' War was mostly a failure, Christian IV's actions during this conflict would become some of the most legendary moments in Danish history and secure his fame and legacy as a national hero. First of all, let us look at what the 30 Years' War was, who was fighting in it, and why it began. The war was a religious conflict and civil war within the Holy Roman Empire, Denmark's southern neighbor, but it also involved a number of foreign actors, which entered and left the war at various points. It is traditionally looked at by dividing it up into four phases: the Bohemian, Danish, Swedish, and French phases, where each of these actors take turn in fighting the emperor's forces. Of course, we will be spending most of our time on the Danish phase, but we will also cover the Bohemian and Swedish phases briefly. The parties in the conflict were these. On one side, you had the alliance of Protestant states within the Holy Roman Empire, mainly based in northern Germany, which were primarily supported by France, Denmark, Sweden, England, Scotland, and the Netherlands. On the other side, you had the Catholic Emperor and the German states supporting him, along with Hungary, Croatia, and Spain, all of which were ruled by the Austrian Habsburg family. You might be wondering why France, which is a Catholic country, would support the Protestants, but that is because the 30 Years' War was not only a religious conflict, but also, especially in the later years, a war of power politics. France felt encircled by the Habsburg family, in the form of Spain to the south and the Holy Roman Empire to the east. They therefore supported the Protestants, at first financially, but later, when the Protestants had depleted most of their manpower, France took the lead themselves in fighting the emperor. Now that we know who will be fighting who, let us begin with some background on the conflict and then jump into the Bohemian phase of the war. The Holy Roman Empire consisted of many different states, cities, kingdoms, and counties, some Protestant and some Catholic. The reason for this coexistence of the different kinds of Christianity had its roots in the Peace Treaty of Augsburg, which was signed in 1555. After many years of war between Protestant nobles and the Catholic Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, the parties agreed to the treaty, which granted Lutheranism official status within the realm. The treaty also established the principle known in Latin as quius regem eius religio, which means whose realm, his religion. The different princes in the empire were allowed to select either Lutheranism or Catholicism, and then their subjects had to follow suit and either convert or emigrate to a different state. One of the problems with the Treaty of Augsburg was that it did not account for the non-Lutheran forms of Protestantism, such as Calvinism. Calvinists thus lived in constant fear of persecution and charges of heresy, and this would lead them to take drastic measures against the Catholics when they feared crackdowns in the time leading up to the Thirty Years' War. Fast forwarding to 1609, we find the Holy Roman Empire under the leadership of Rudolf II, who is also King of Bohemia, the area today known as Czechia. He was lenient towards the majority Protestant population of Bohemia, and not only refrained from enforcing the principle of whose realm his religion, but gradually increased their rights. When Rudolf died, he was followed by his younger brother, who pursued the same tolerant policy, but the Kingdom of Bohemia and the Holy Roman Empire would next pass to a cousin, Ferdinand. Ferdinand was a hardline Catholic who had been raised by the Jesuits, and so he was not satisfied with the leniency which had been shown towards the Protestants of Bohemia up until his ascension. He therefore revoked the royal decree which had granted them freedom of religion, and this led to the famous defenestration of Prague in May 1618. Defenestration means throwing someone out of a window, and that is exactly what the Protestants did to the Catholic nobles who showed up in Prague to discuss the conflict which had arisen from the revocation of the royal decree. This action sparked a full-blown rebellion among the Protestants, and in particular the Calvinists, who chose as their leader the Calvinist Frederick V, who became King of Bohemia. In this way, the Bohemian phase began, and it lasted for 2 years, from 1618 to 1620, ending with the defeat of the Protestants in the Battle of White Mountain, near Prague. Both the English and Danish kings had familial connections to Frederick V, but had not intervened, although the heavy-handed treatment of the Bohemian Protestants by the emperor led to them condemning Ferdinand's actions. The war soon expanded when the German state of Saxony joined the rebellion, while the King of Spain, who was a nephew of the Holy Roman Emperor, joined the Catholics. In 1621, Denmark, England and the Netherlands signed a treaty of friendship, and England in particular was warming up to the idea of helping the rebels. Christian IV of Denmark, meanwhile, succeeded with a scheme to have his second eldest son, who was called Frederick, appointed as the Prince Bishop of Verden, a German city located southwest of the Duchy of Holstein. Although the title of Prince Bishop was formally a clerical one, the bishopric had in practice become a secular principality after the Reformation. In the next 3 years, the fighting continued in Germany, mostly in favor of the emperor, whose armies were under the command of Johann Czarklaes, the Count of Tilly, and Albrecht von Wallenstein, who was a Bohemian, and they fought in the northern German states. England finally decided in 1624 to try and get Frederick V reinstated, and they encouraged both Christian IV of Denmark, as well as Gustavus Adolphus of Sweden, to enter the war and lead the Protestant coalition. The King of Sweden had had a lot of success in the Baltic, capturing Riga in modern-day Latvia in 1621. Everything pointed towards him wanting to circle around the Baltic into Poland, and from there expand Swedish influence in northern Germany. Christian IV wanted to beat him to it, and feared that if he did not enter the war now, Gustavus Adolphus would take the initiative and become the leader of the Protestants in northern Europe. Christian IV thus responded favorably to the English proposal, and was also promised support from the Netherlands and France. He began negotiations with the Danish council to let him declare war, and these took place throughout 1624. The council, however, would not let him get involved, so he used his old trick from the Kalmar War. He threatened to declare the war in his position as Duke of Holstein and not as King of Denmark. Of course, the distinction was almost completely meaningless in practice, but this was the loophole that Christian exploited when the council could not be swayed. When Denmark entered the war in 1625, however, there were a number of problems which disadvantaged Christian IV significantly right from the get-go. France faced a Protestant rebellion in the southwest, and so could not deliver on the aid it had promised. Saxony and Brandenburg had made peace with the Catholics, Sweden was fighting Poland, so no help was coming from them, and the assistance he got from the Netherlands and England was less than what was promised, and it also largely arrived too late. In addition to this, Christian also seems to have been ignorant of the size of the German forces, especially those of Albrecht Wallenstein, who came to the aid of his colleague Johann Tsarclaes when Denmark invaded. Nonetheless, Christian received the support of Mecklenburg, Pomerania, and Brunswick, and headed south from Holstein to confront the enemy. His ally, the Duke of Brunswick, had been defeated by Wallenstein in the Battle of Dessau Bridge in the spring of 1626. But the two German armies were separated, and so Christian's plan was to attack Johann Tsarclaes before Wallenstein could link up with him. This plan became unfeasible in late July, however, when Tsarclaes received 4,300 men from his partner, bringing his total numbers up to 20,000, close to the size of the Danish army. Christian therefore turned around and retreated, but rain had turned the roads to mud, and the army was also ravaged by disease and hunger. The lands had been severely pillaged during the conflict, which had already lasted for almost 10 years at this point. The Danish army made its stand close to the small village of Lutter am Barnberge, for which the following battle is named. The fighting opened with an exchange of cannon fire, with the Danes for whatever reason only using a few of their guns. Tsarclaes then ordered his infantry, equipped with long pikes, to charge the Danish line. The Catholics made some gains, but their assault was repulsed. Christian then led a counterattack, but was himself pushed back, and in this retreat back to their own lines, the forces under his command became disorganized and broke formation. Now vulnerable, the Danish forces were charged on both wings by the enemy cavalry, and once again in the center by the infantry, and they were completely routed. King Christian had 4 horses shot out from under him and was forced to flee with 80 of his riders. The casualties for the Danes were astonishing, and unusual for a battle in this time period. Of the 20,000 men, 6,000 were killed and 2,500 were taken prisoner, meaning that Christian lost almost half of his soldiers. The remains of the army withdrew north, back into Holstein, after the disaster at the Battle of Lutter am Barnberg, and Christian IV now convinced the Danish council to issue a war tax, as well as a contribution from the nobility, at a meeting of the estates in January 1627. Although Christian had ignored the council and waged the war as Duke of Holstein, it was now clear that Denmark itself was threatened, and so the nobility agreed to fund the war. Johann Tsarclaes followed the Danes north and entered Holstein in August, and they were soon joined by Albrecht von Wallenstein, who had finished fighting in Bohemia. The massive German force occupied both the duchies, and in October they even moved into Jutland, which they also conquered. The mercenary forces pillaged the Danish cities to get the supplies they needed, which was a common practice by this point in the Thirty Years' War. The next year, 1628, Wallenstein subdued almost all of Mecklenburg and Pomerania, the only significant holdout being Stralsund. He was also made Duke of Mecklenburg by the Emperor, and also received the title of Admiral of the North and Baltic Seas, indicating plans to build a navy that could challenge the Danes and Swedes at sea. As it was, the Germans could not move on from Jutland, since the Danish navy made raids on the occupied cities and destroyed their capacity for shipbuilding. Nonetheless, the Danes were in a very tight spot, with both the duchies and Jutland under total German control. The imperial forces calculated, however, that the potential loot they could acquire from conquering the rest of the Danish isles would not make up for the expenses associated with constructing a fleet, and they therefore began to consider making peace with Denmark. This would not come just yet, though, as there was still one more battle ahead. The siege of the fortified city of Stralsund was now the epicenter of the war, and it would in fact broaden the conflict in just a few years by bringing Sweden into the war for good. Between 1626 and 1629, King Gustavus Adolphus was waging war on Poland, a Catholic country and an ally of the Holy Roman Empire, the goal being to reach Pomerania and establish dominance over the Baltic Sea. When Christian IV reached out with a proposal to cooperate in the defense of Stralsund, the King of Sweden agreed, as the siege would be a useful thorn in the side for the Germans. Along with Danish soldiers and Scottish mercenaries, Stralsund therefore received reinforcements from Sweden, and managed to hold out against Wallenstein and his forces. The troops inside launched raids on the besieging army, and the Germans were also hindered by bad weather, which turned the battlefield into a swamp. Wallenstein therefore called off the siege and headed east, where a Danish army under the command of King Christian had landed at the city of Wolgast and been welcomed inside. Preparing for the battle to the west of the town, the king chose a marshy battlefield near the coast. He used between 5,000 and 6,000 of his troops in the battle, of which 1,500 were cavalry, while Wallenstein had more, between 7,000 and 8,000. The Battle of Wolgast was another disaster for the Danes, as the Germans smashed through their flank, killing 1,000 of their men and capturing another 600. Christian IV and the rest of his army fled the following night by ship and sailed back to Denmark, while the Germans pushed on to Wolgast and took the city, capturing the Danish garrison of 500 men there. Thus ended the Danish phase of the 30 Years' War, with the total defeat of Christian IV's expedition and the occupation of Schleswig, Holstein and Jutland. Peace negotiations began in January 1629 in Lübeck, and things were looking grim for the Danes. However, with Sweden on the verge of entering the war, and the Germans recognizing that challenging the Scandinavians in the Baltic Sea would be too difficult, the Treaty of Lübeck, which was signed in May 1629, proved to be very generous for Denmark. This was also helped by the fact that Christian IV arranged a meeting with Gustavus Adolphus in southwestern Sweden. This action sent a signal to the Germans that if they did not show leniency, then Denmark might join forces with their neighbor and continue the war. This was probably what the Swedish king wanted, but Christian settled for the Treaty of Lübeck, which restored to him all occupied territories as long as he withdrew from the war. However, his son Frederick was also removed as the Prince Bishop of Verden. Christian IV spent the 1630s rebuilding the country and his own finances. In this period, we see taxes rise dramatically. The king quarreled more and more with the council, which he accused of not having helped him enough in the war, and also of nearly accepting the initial German demands. The peasants of Jutland also protested the behavior of the nobility during the war, saying that they had been abandoned, and adding that they were being exploited in general. Christian did listen to their protests, but ultimately decided not to take action against the nobility. Meanwhile, the 30 Years' War entered the Swedish phase when Gustavus Adolphus launched his invasion of the Holy Roman Empire in 1630 by landing his army in Wolgast, at the same spot used by the Danes. The Swedes had the advantage of receiving more support from other nations than Denmark had. France, in particular, was now able to increase its funding of the Protestants due to the end of their internal conflicts in the southwest. Another advantage was that Sweden had just concluded their wars in the east against Poland. This had secured their gains in the Baltic, but also added Polish coastal cities to their dominions, and they were able to acquire western Pomerania as well. The Swedish army was professional, experienced, and under brilliant leadership in the form of Gustavus Adolphus. The King of Sweden, now allied with Protestant Saxony, moved against the imperial forces under Johann Sarclays, who now had supreme command after the dismissal of Wallenstein in 1630. The two sides met near Leipzig in the legendary Battle of Breitenfeld in September 1631. The Swedes were at first pushed back, but then used their mobile and accurate artillery to cause chaos in the enemy ranks, and ended up inflicting 27,000 casualties on the enemy army, which numbered 35,000 men, a rate of over 75%. Following this stunning victory, the Protestants gained the upper hand in the war, and Gustavus Adolphus pushed south into Bohemia and Bavaria, where he faced Johann Sarclays once again. Near the city of Rhein in southern Germany, the imperial forces attempted to prevent the Swedes from crossing a river, but they were outnumbered 40,000 to 25,000. Gustavus Adolphus utilized his Finnish light cavalry troops, known as Hakapelita, to cross the river and establish a bridgehead, which he then used to storm the imperial positions and rout the enemy. In the fighting, Johann Sarclays was wounded by a cannonball, and he died from his injuries, leaving the army leaderless. The Swedes now looked poised to advance into the Austrian heartlands, but Emperor Ferdinand recalled Wallenstein to service, and he quickly raised a new army to fight off the Swedes. The next battle took place southwest of Nuremberg, and this time the Germans won, sending the invaders back north due to supply issues. When they clashed for the final time in the Battle of Lützen in November 1632, the two sides were about equally matched, with around 20,000 troops each. The battlefield was very foggy, and where the armies clashed, a confused melee ensued. While leading a cavalry charge, King Gustavus Adolphus was wounded in the left arm by a bullet, and his horse, too, took one in the neck, making it hard to control. With the fog making it hard to see where he was going, the king suddenly found himself in the middle of the enemy lines, surrounded. Here he was shot in the back and fell from his horse before suffering a fatal shot to the head. Although the battle as a whole was a Swedish victory, they lost many men, and with their king dead, they began the march back to Sweden. The body of Gustavus Adolphus was embalmed and eventually brought in a long funeral procession from Valkast to Stockholm, where it was buried. The death of the greatest king of Sweden meant that France now took the leading role in the anti-Habsburg War, and would carry on the fighting until the Peace of Westphalia in 1648. The Swedish phase of the Thirty Years' War thus ended formally in 1635, having seen much more success than the Danish, and putting the country on the path to becoming the dominant power in Northern Europe. Christian IV, meanwhile, had acted as a mediator after the Swedish offensive in the Holy Roman Empire ground to a halt. This let him secure the Prince-Bishopric of Verden once more, by having his second eldest son, Frederick, reinstated as bishop. In 1638, King Christian convinced the Danish council to let him establish a standing army, in an attempt to rebuild the military might of Denmark. This proved expensive, however, and so he sought to improve his own personal finances by raising the sound due, the revenue from which went directly to his coffers. He made a fatal mistake, however, when he also levied a tax on Swedish ships coming from their new possessions, such as Western Pomerania. Christian argued that these did not fall under the tax exemption which the rest of Sweden enjoyed, but, naturally, the Swedes disagreed, and so they formed a 15-year alliance with the Netherlands against Denmark. The two countries then forced Christian to lower the sound due the next year, but tensions were still running high. The king then tried something else. He demanded money from all ships sailing on the Elbe River in Holstein, most of which were going to Hamburg. He would soon have other things to worry about, though. The regency, which was now in charge of Sweden, had estimated that their military might would enable them to make gains in a potential war with Denmark. In addition, the Swedish army was currently in northern Germany and could easily attack northwards, and Jutland as well as the duchies had not fully recovered from the Danish phase of the Thirty Years' War. The regency of Sweden therefore sent orders to Field Marshal Lennart Torstensson, and in December of 1643, his army entered Holstein unannounced. This surprise war caught the Danes off guard. The duchies were occupied in just 2 weeks, and by the end of January 1644, the Swedes had taken over Jutland as well. Christian sought the aid of the Holy Roman Empire, now re-entering the Thirty Years' War on the other side, and received 6,000 German troops with which to fight the Swedes and Dutchmen. Sweden continued to advance. In February, the general Gustav Horn attacked the provinces of Halland and Scania with 11,000 men and took everything except for Malmö. The Danish strategy was to hold on to the islands as well as Norway and then fight the Swedes at sea. The navy had some success. They defeated a Dutch fleet off the western coast of Schleswig when they tried to send reinforcements to Sweden. In Norway, the forces under Governor-General Hannibal Sehested fought with the Swedes in the border areas of Jämtland and Heyerdahlen, at first losing some ground, but then beating back the enemy. Meanwhile, the Swedes had taken the island of Femarn, and the Danish fleet sailed against them. The result was the Battle of Kolberga Heide, in which 40 Danish ships met 43 Swedish ones. The fighting produced no clear victor. No ships were sunk, and there were only between 30 and 40 killed on each side. So the battle is most often called a stalemate. Perhaps a small victory for the Danes, since they managed to trap the Swedes inside the Bay of Kiel. The Battle of Kolberga Heide is still significant, though, due to how it was portrayed in Danish history in the centuries afterwards. It was perceived as the last Danish victory over Sweden in the long-running conflict about dominion of the Baltic Sea, and the actions of King Christian IV were also subject to glorification. While in battle on his flagship, the Trinity, the 66-year-old king was wounded in the head by shrapnel from a cannonball, knocking him down. Surprisingly, Christian rose from the deck of the ship, bleeding, and encouraged his men to continue the fight. He would live the last 4 years of his life without his right eye. This event became a favorite motif of 19th-century painters such as Wilhelm Marstrand, who made a famous painting which now adorns Christian's chapel in the Roskilde Cathedral. In the painting, the old king strikes a powerful pose, standing upright with his sword touching the deck and his arm outstretched as if he were a Roman emperor. He is clad in dark blue and white, with a bandage wrapped around his face, and all around him his men hail him for his heroism. In poetry, too, did the image of the aging Christian IV shrugging off his wounds and leading the battle seem appealing. In 1778, the dramatist and poet Johannes Ewald wrote a play in which the lyrics of King Christian stood by the lofty mast glorified the king and other Danish naval heroes. When music was later added to the poem, it became one of the two national anthems of Denmark, the other being There Is a Lovely Country, which is the song I use for the intro and outro of the history of Denmark. For this episode, I chose to change the music to King Christian Stood by the Lofty Mast, because we covered the Battle of Kolberger Heide today. Although it has status of national anthem, it is mostly used in military and royal contexts, whereas There Is a Lovely Country is used for other occasions where you would expect the national anthem to be played. The Battle of Kolberger Heide was a minor victory, though, and the Swedes were not trapped in the Bay of Kiel for long. They broke out shortly after, and, linking up with their Dutch allies, they faced the Danes in October 1644 in the Battle of Fehmarn. The 16 Swedish and 21 Dutch ships smashed 17 Danish ones, capturing 10 of them and wrecking 2, taking 1,000 prisoners. With this victory, the Swedes were now masters of the Baltic Sea, and could initiate the peace negotiations. With a French diplomat as mediator, the two sides met at Bremsebro, a bridge spanning a river at the border between Sweden and the Danish province of Blekinge. After several months of negotiations, the Treaty of Bremsebro ended the so-called Torstensson War, named after the Swedish general. Sweden would be exempted from the Sound Dew, the issue which had started the war to begin with, and they would gain the island of Ösel off the coast of Estonia, the island of Gotland in the middle of the Baltic, the border areas of Jämtland and Härjedalen between Norway and Sweden, and finally, the Prince Bishopric of Verden was lost for the second time. They would also be given the province of Halland for a period of 30 years. All in all, the war was a disaster for Denmark, who now had no way of contesting the Swedish dominance of the Baltic Sea and had to accept that the Sound Dew would no longer apply to their biggest rival. Denmark would try to reverse this state of affairs 3 times, in the Carl Gustaf Wars, the Scanian War, and the Great Northern War, but all 3 attempts would fail. Sweden had entered Stormaktstiden, the era of great power, and after the Peace of Westphalia in 1648, which finally ended the 30 Years' War, Sweden was the 3rd largest country in Europe by land area. As for the Holy Roman Empire, the war resulted in its decentralization, and it would now become a mess of German states for the next 200 years. The empire had lost 1/3 of its population, in certain areas it was even higher, and had suffered under the decades of warfare, plundering and devastation which internal and external actors had caused. The final catastrophe to strike Christian IV before he passed away in 1648 was the death of his eldest son Christian, who was the heir apparent for many years. Next time we will deal with the king's attempt to get the council to accept his second eldest son, Frederick, as king. As I mentioned a few times already, he had been the ruler of the Prince Bishopric of Verden twice already, but now he would have to succeed his father as King Frederick III. Before we end today, though, I want to talk about Christian IV's legacy, even though we won't say goodbye to him until next time. Of course, as I mentioned, with respect to the royal anthem and the famous painting, he was glorified in the 19th century when nationalism swept across Denmark in the wake of the Napoleonic Wars. He was praised for bravely leading his men and constructing many buildings, particularly in Copenhagen, which we covered last time. But starting in the late 19th century and continuing through the 20th century, many historians began to look at Christian IV through a more critical lens. Let us look through this lens ourselves and review his downsides as king. His enormous ego and carelessness threw Denmark into one of the most destructive European wars ever, ostensibly to prevent Sweden from taking charge of the Protestants in Europe, but that would turn out to happen anyway due to the king's catastrophic failures in conducting the war. He attacked without secure alliances and without the agreement of his council, as well as an inferior military force. He lost almost every battle, and he did especially poorly in the ones where he himself was in command. The economy tanked during his reign, and he increased taxes dramatically, further angering the Danish council. When he tried to remedy this by adjusting the sound dune and taxing the Elbe River, he provoked Sweden and suffered another defeat in a war which he was utterly unprepared for. The duchies of Schleswig and Holstein, as well as Jutland, were taken over twice during his reign. Cities were looted and thousands of people lost their lives. Not only the soldiers who were killed in battle against the Germans and Swedes, but also civilians in the occupied areas, both in Denmark and in other countries. And even if you ignore all the ordinary people who died, and judge Christian by the metrics which are most favorable to him, his reign was still a catastrophe. Just go back and listen to the terms of the Treaty of Bremsebro. We also haven't even talked about his failure to counter his son-in-law, Corfitz Ulfeldt, who not only caused great problems for the king in his own lifetime, but, as we shall see, will soon have a hand in one of the greatest disasters to ever hit Denmark. All in all, Christian IV is lucky to have been glorified in the way that he was. Because if you simply judge his reign in the way Mike Duncan did in the History of Rome, by asking whether or not he left the realm in a better state than he found it, you will find that he most certainly did not. In more recent times, his personality and private correspondence have been in the spotlight, and he is regarded today for all his flaws as an iconic character. That was all for this second episode about the reign of Christian IV. We have covered his involvement in the Thirty Years' War, as well as that conflict in general, followed by the Torstensson War, and a look at the legacy of the most famous king of Denmark. We also learned how the royal anthem, King Christian Stood by the Lofty Mast, got its title and first verse. You can hear the rest of it in the outro music. Next time, we will say goodbye to Christian and see how his successor, Frederick III, handles the new state of affairs. Thank you for listening to the History of Denmark. If you like this podcast, please share it with a friend and consider giving it a review on iTunes. Until next time, goodbye.